This is an oral history of Dr. Glenn J. Sprandio concerning the development of the Purdue School of Pharmacy and Pharmacosciences during his tenure as a teaching staff and faculty member and administrator from 1945 to 1984, conducted by Theodora Andrews, Professor of Library Science, Pharmacy, Nursing, and Health Sciences Librarian. Dr. Sprandio, from reading your biography, I know that you were born in a small town in southern Illinois and were educated at the St. Louis College of Pharmacy, having received your B.S. degree there and your M.S. and Ph.D. degrees at Purdue. What factors influenced your decision to choose the pharmaceutical sciences, and specifically the teaching of pharmacy practice as a career?
I think that probably both of these just happened, because as I grew up in Edwardsville, our neighbor next door asked me if I'd like to work as a curb service boy in his drugstore. So I began working in a pharmacy at the age of 12 and continued ever since. When I graduated from high school, I had the choice of either going to College of Pharmacy at St. Louis, which was within commuting distance of home, or not going to college at all, because we were in such a situation that my parents really couldn't afford to send me to college. So I began studying pharmacy, because at that time I had already had 5 or 6 years practice in a drugstore. And then when I completed my BS degree, I spent the next 5 years working in industry in St. Louis, and saw in the industrial setting that an advanced degree was the only way to really get ahead in the profession. So I came to Purdue, and again, the teaching just happened, because I was given a teaching assistantship the first year, and subsequent to that, I was given an instructorship and just stayed on.
Would you comment about work in the pharmaceutical industry? I believe you did for a short time. Okay.
Yes, at the time, this was in the early 1940s, I was working in a community pharmacy, and the director of the pharmacy labs at Grove Laboratories asked me if I would like a job working only half as many hours with more pay. So I went to work for Grove Laboratories as an analytical chemist, and spent several years there, and then I went to William R. Warner, which was a large manufacturing laboratory in St. Louis, as the assistant head of a tablet manufacturing department. And you got to remember, this was during World War II, and at that time the work that I was doing was considered to be essential to the war effort, and I was restricted in changing from one job to another. To make a long story short, while I was at Warner's I had a chance to go back to the Grove Laboratories in a more advanced capacity as directing product development research. So I went back to Grove's, and then I realized for the first time that a graduate degree was really critical to advancing in industry. So I applied to the best graduate school in the nation, and because there was a shortage of eligible men at that time during the end of the war, I was accepted, and that led to the gradual development of a career.
After completing the PhD, you accepted a position at Purdue as an instructor in pharmacy, and subsequently were promoted several times, obtaining the rank of professor in 1962. Then in 1968, you became an associate dean of the school. Prior to becoming associate dean, you served as head of the Department of Pharmacy Practice. But first, before we talk about those things, will you give us your thoughts about the formative years in the school?
Well, those really were the formative years of the school, because at that time, Dean Jenkins had been at Purdue just prior to the beginning of the World War. I think he came to Purdue in 1941. And he was very progressive and aggressive. At the time I came to Purdue, the full-time faculty consisted of 8 professors and 1 librarian. And Dean Jenkins was building as quickly as he could and recruiting as quickly as he could. And by the year 1947, when I was an instructor, there were 10 full-time staff members. And these were Drs. Lee and DeKay, Data and Edwards, John Christian and myself, George Osborne, Dr. Zufall, Dean Jenkins, and did I say Data? Dr. John Data. He had just come, and Swalina. To show you how Dean Jenkins built the school so quickly, when I came in 1945, there were 15 graduate students, and then 2 years later, the number of graduate students had grown to 35 in a 2-year period of time. Dean Jenkins pushed all of his faculty to the utmost. He believed strongly in doing your job and doing it as best you could, and he really made the school grow as a result of making his faculty grow. He expected us to work Saturday mornings. Every faculty member was supposed to be in his office until noon on Saturday. He insisted that we maintain our facilities neatly, and every Friday he'd make a tour of inspection of the whole building to tell us if we were in any way deficient in his opinion. But the basic idea of establishing Purdue as a leader in graduate study was indeed Dean Jenkins, and he devoted all of his energy to this until his career ended. There's so much about the growth of the school. We went what was called a temporary annex in 1947, which doubled the space that we had, and expanded beyond it. And for the last 10 years of his career here, Dean Jenkins had one primary goal, and that was to obtain a new building. He initiated the demand for it, developed the plans for it, and worked hard to gain funding for it. I think.
All right, now let's go on here, and you talk about what you were your responsibilities when you were the associate dean of the school, and before that when you were the head of the Department of Pharmacy Practice. However, we'll talk later about the development of the clinical pharmacy program, so you can leave that part out for now.
Well, so much of this again was just sort of a natural growth, I guess, and a progression into larger efforts. As an instructor and assistant professor of pharmacy, I was responsible for the areas of patient services, which really was the basis for the later development of clinical pharmacy. This included prescription compounding and dispensing, hospital pharmacy, and cosmetics, which I felt strongly belonged to the area of pharmacy and should be expanded as a possible career alternative. The primary responsibilities of all of us in the early days were first teaching and then second research. And as the years went by, research became extremely more important, and we were all urged to do everything that we could to advance ourselves by advancing the areas in which we worked. This was how the reputation of Purdue grew, because Dean Jenkins insisted that we be professionally active, that we participate in professions, we join organizations, and that we make our names and Purdue's name known. And he instilled in me a strong belief that your programs and your schools are made possible best by getting the very best people you can find and helping them achieve their potential. And I really think that was the secret of Dean Jenkins' success, because every person who did work under him as a staff member or as a graduate student, when they left Purdue, they went on and became extremely prominent in their chosen field. And for many years, Purdue was known as the ultimate in graduate study and professional performance.
Is there anything you'd like to add about your administrative career when you were associate dean and when you were head of the department before we go on to your research?
Well, the school was departmentalized in 1966 when Dean Tyler came, although Dean Jenkins had earlier set the stage for that by establishing the Department of Medicinal Chemistry. That was a department by itself before all the other departments were formed. And at the time he established the departments in 1966, clinical pharmacy was just becoming recognized as a component of the service. As a department head, it was my responsibility to first build a strong department, a cadre of good people who would then advance the programs in which we were interested. And my second responsibility as a department head was to make sure that what we did was known and recognized around the country. And in order to do this, again, it was necessary for us to write articles, to have papers read at meetings, to get out and advertise ourselves. And it was this belief that encouraged us to become active in all of the professional organizations. And then by becoming known, we were able to make more contacts and acquire more grants and financial support to build a stronger program. As an administrator, though, I do want to say the whole thrust of one's activities was different. Administration is an extremely important part of building a school, and we had to have good, strong policies which recognize students, their abilities, their rights, and their obligations. And again, we were to establish policies and rules and guidelines for everything like interviewing students prior to their admission to the school and having councils of the students to get student feedback as to teacher effectiveness and program likings, and interviewing students to encourage them to expand their horizons and look beyond any one facet of pharmacy as a career. Many schools at that time, you know, were training students to be druggists, and Purdue trained them to be pharmacists, because realizing that not all students wanted to work in a drugstore, there were plenty of other opportunities for the cosmetic industry, for hospital work, for community services, everything else. So as an administrator, my job was to establish and strengthen these programs and to do everything that was necessary to support the dean.
If I remember correctly, we had two associate deans at the time those positions were set up, and you were the associate dean for undergraduate education, is that correct? And
yes, prior to let me think a minute now. Initially, we had one associate dean and one assistant dean. And then Dr. Swalina was the associate dean. And when he retired, there was considerable feeling on the part of the faculty that the assistant dean should have equal status with the associate dean, because they had two totally divergent responsibilities, each of which was equally important. So at that time, the assistant dean was changed to the associate dean for undergraduate affairs, and the other assistant associate dean remained as associate dean for graduate affairs. And this was the way that we originally began that. And then later that we called the associate dean for undergraduate affairs the associate dean for professional affairs.
Yes, now I want you to talk a little bit more about your research interests, and particularly comment about your work in the cosmetic field and your consulting activities in this area.
Well, having been in industry formulation, my research interests focused generally upon the preparation of drug products and the things that went into them and how we could improve them and what they did. And initially, my research was focused upon the skin and the effect of medications on the skin and how much of these medications would be absorbed and have a systemic effect. In fact, my first PhD student did a thesis on a study of the absorption of estrone from creams and ointments to see if there was a difference between that which came from an oily base and that from a water miscible base. This naturally then led to more studies of the skin and the effect that materials put on the skin had, and what could be more natural than cosmetics. In the early 1950s, there was considerable scare about the use of certain dyes in lipsticks causing cancer. And we started to look into all aspects of cosmetic preparations and found a tremendously fascinating field, because cosmetics are just basically pharmaceutical preparations without the active drug. And I used to tell my students so often that a lipstick is the same composition as a suppository, except that it has a dye in it instead of medication. Likewise, all the creams and lotions and emulsions were pharmaceutical products. So pharmacy, cosmetics, really belong to pharmacy. I espoused this philosophy, and in the early 1960s, the American Medical Association invited me to give a talk on the safety of cosmetics at the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences annual meeting in New York City. And in order to, I was convinced that cosmetics properly formulated were safe. And in order to make my point, or to prove my point, I made a lotion, a complexion lotion. And I thought at that time how they best described the perfect complexion, it was peaches and cream. So I made a lotion out of peaches and cream and used this to emphasize my points at the meeting. And this was the thing that really generated worldwide publicity for me and for Purdue. We received literally thousands of inquiries and newspaper clippings and reports from all over the world asking about the new idea of having natural products in cosmetics, having safe cosmetics. As you can imagine, this led to a lot more contacts, so we were able to attract graduate students not only to my department but to the School of Pharmacy to study pharmacology and medicinal chemistry and all other components of pharmacy which in some way impacted upon products that people would use. We established a course in cosmetics at school, and many of our students took it as an elective and enjoyed it. I still have occasional contact with students who have gone into the industry. And we have a number of our graduates who are prominent in the cosmetic world. And I can think of one particular who's out in Hollywood working with the studios and with his own private formulation company out there. Is there anything else that you want to know about that? We could go on like this forever, but time is limited.
Well, didn't you consult for a number of cosmetic firms?
I consulted for a number of cosmetic firms and industries over the years to a limited extent because I was quite busy with professional organization work, with my teaching, my research, and my other duties at school, and I usually limited my consult activities to one company at a time. Through consultations, we also received additional grants to do studies, which weren't specifically limited to cosmetics. They were more limited to systemic interactions and the formulation of new products. For example, as a direct result of some of these contacts and studies, and we published these, but we didn't commercialize them, we were the first to develop a sustained release type of topical application. We used a very crude method at that time of absorbing medicine onto an ion exchange resin, which was then placed in a plastic bandage so that we could have, in essence, a band-aid which would be worn, which would release medication over a longer period of time. And this now is really the same basis that they use for these patches of insulin and nitroglycerin and intradural dermal products that are widely used. We were the first to develop a sustained release aspirin. We use a process called microencapsulation to produce drugs which could be dissolved slowly at a regular rate of time and have a predictable therapeutic effect. We developed, back to cosmetics, I'm just recalling now things that we did. We developed the first lipstick that had a sunscreen built into it. And we developed cosmetic powder, a base, which could be transported overseas because it didn't contain water. It was light, and then water and or oil could be added to it to give a cream or an ointment of any consistency. And this led to a contract with the quartermaster's office. We served as consultants to the government. We were asked to develop a cream that would the soldiers could use that would prevent them from getting burned from atomic blasts. And we worked for 2 or 3 years with the Quartermaster Corps. We developed a face cream that they did use in the field and with some degree of success. We've had so many other spin-offs from this. This led to a study of intravenous fluids and stability of injections that the Army used in the fields. And then that led into a whole lot of work in hospital pharmacy in that area.
I expect you could go on a little further, but we'll get on to the next question now. You served in the U.S. Coast Guard in 1944. Did any experiences you had during that time influence any decisions later?
Well, no, that was a short experience, and I must explain that when the draft came along in 1941, I was drafted, but I was placed in 4F because of a heart murmur. And subsequent to that, everyone was extremely patriotic and wanted to serve their country. I volunteered for the Army and the Navy and was not accepted, and eventually I was accepted by the Coast Guard Reserve and assigned to limited duty, and my active duty was for a short period of time on the Mississippi River, and didn't do anything other than convince me that I ought to be back in pharmacy.
I know you've been very active in a number of professional organizations and have held offices in them. These include the American Pharmaceutical Association, the American Society of Hospital Pharmacists, American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, Indiana Pharmaceutical Association, Tippecanoe County Pharmaceutical Association, Indiana Society of Hospital Pharmacists, Florida Pharmaceutical Association, Society of Cosmetic Chemists, and the Parenteral Drug Association. And then there are some honorary societies that you belong to. Would you comment on what role these organizations have played in your professional life and also on their influence on the school?
The first role they played in my professional life was to enable me to become acquainted with all the leaders of American pharmacy, both in education and industry and in government. The second thing they did, I think, was give me the opportunity to contribute to a lot of these organizations by being involved in their activities. I strongly believe that if you belong to an organization, you ought to contribute to it. And I tried my best to do this. In the American Pharmaceutical Association, and now we're talking about when I first went into it, it was divided into two divisions, a section on practical pharmacy and a section on scientific pharmacy. And I became an officer of the section of practical pharmacy and worked with the national people for a good many years to build up that society. And the American Society of Hospital Pharmacists at that time was a growing organization. I became a good friend of Don Franke, who was active in that and one of the founders of it. And through my association with him, we got him to agree to be a co-author of a text, which Dean Jenkins edited, and we'll talk about a little bit later on. One thing that I do want to mention, one organization that I was pleased to be involved in was the Parenteral Drug Association. It's a national organization composed of representatives from the major pharmaceutical industries, and I at that time was the first academic person to be a member of the board of directors of that group. I served on the board of directors for a number of years, and ultimately was asked to be the president of that group. And I declined that because I felt strongly that an industrial group should have its key leaders members of the industry rather than academia. But anyhow, I worked in that group and made a lot of industrial contacts, which again came back to Purdue in the form of both grants and other graduate students. I want to mention the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, too, because that organization was important, and Dean Jenkins, again, encouraged us, in fact, insisted that we actively become involved in that. So I was chairman of several committees there and helped helped establish that as a active supporter of faculty as well as of the institutions alone.
During your career, you've received many honors, including a Distinguished Alumnus Award from the St. Louis College of Pharmacy in 1969, a recipient of the Lederle Faculty Pharmacy Award, as well as some others. Would you name some of the others and tell what they have meant to you and how they've contributed to the success and prestige of the school?
I guess my story wouldn't be complete without mentioning the Kappa Psi Pharmaceutical Fraternity. It's not an honorary society, but I was made a member as an honor for work I had done with the local chapter at Purdue. I became a national officer of Kappa Psi and served as Grand Regent for two terms, and of course consequently received from it citations of merit and expressions of appreciation and a couple of awards. I am most proud, I guess, of a couple of recognitions that were given me on my retirement. I was a member of the NABP, the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy Blue Ribbon Committee. And this was the committee that was initially started to write and prepare the standard nationalized examination for licensure, which all pharmacists are now taking. I got a plaque from them recognizing my efforts on that part, and I value that very much. I also have a special recognition by the Indiana State Board of Pharmacy for extended and continuous service to the profession, which is at this time the only such recognition that the State Board has ever given, and I was quite pleased with that. One other recognition that means a lot to me is something that, again, is not too widely known, but in 1959, I started writing a feature for Eli Lilly and Company called Hospital Pharmacy Notes. And this was extremely successful. It continued for 16 years. And for several years was the basis for Lilly's exhibits at their annual meetings. And it was simply a commentary and an updating on developments and philosophies of hospital pharmacy practice. And the conclusion, on my retirement, I guess it was, Lilly gave me a special plaque with the first page of the first issue reproduced on it, and a nice statement commemorating the recognition that they wanted to give me for that. I should say, too, that I was pleased to receive honorary membership in the Golden Key Society. And also, I guess, to make the record complete, I received a Distinguished Educator Award, Distinguished Educator of the Year, from the Indiana Society of Hospital Pharmacists, and a plaque for outstanding research achievements from the Parenteral Drug Association, and I've got a dozen other plaques at home, but I can't remember what they are. That can be left out.
Well, thank you very much for that. Anyway, you do have had an award, a name for you that called the Glenn J. Sprandu Award for the Advancement of Pharmacy Practice. Now, I want you to talk about that a little bit and what that might have meant to the school.
Well, it means a lot to me, and I hope that it will mean something to the school. When I retired, I told my colleagues that I did not want any type of retirement banquet or celebration, and I really didn't want it. But Dean Tyler and the department heads did schedule a special luncheon for me, sort of a farewell luncheon. And at that time, they presented me with two things, a beautiful hand-drawn portrait, which were done by the university artist, which I still have in my home, and the establishment of the Glenn J. Sprandio Award for the Advancement of Pharmacy Practice. This is an award that's given every year to a practicing pharmacist in the state who has contributed significantly to the improvement of pharmacy practice. And this is special because it's the only award that is given to a practicing pharmacist, and faculty members are not eligible for the award, and the award is chosen by an impartial committee composed of representatives of the state associations, the state board, the Indiana Hospital Pharmacist Society, and the schools, and industry, and the chain drug stores. I'm pleased of that because I consider it to be means of recognizing the advancements of so many of the pharmacists out in the field who don't have the opportunity to make themselves nationally known, but who contribute every bit as much to the growth and strength of pharmacy as do the prominent people at the national level.
Now, I notice that you have served as a consultant to a number of organizations and agencies, as well as having served as a consultant to industry. Do you want to comment a little bit about these activities? Anything additional that you haven't said?
Well, in addition to the NABP, the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. I think I was most pleased to be consultant to the Surgeon General of the Army, a consultant on clinical pharmacy, and I served in that capacity for 5 or 6 years until I felt that I did not any longer have the time to go to Washington, to go to wherever they might want to send me. I also was a consultant for Lilly. Well, I don't put that in, because that was with hospital pharmacy. And a couple of the cosmetic companies. I can't remember any of that.
There have been many changes and developments in the School of Pharmacy since you began your career there in 1945. Also, there have been changes in the profession and in the healthcare and scientific fields that influenced these changes. When you were head of the Department of Pharmacy Practice, what changes influenced the direction of the department?
Well, I guess it's time to start talking about clinical pharmacy.
That was going to be the next question, but go ahead.
Okay. The really most significant change in the growth of the department and the development of the department and the national image of the pharmacist, as well as the entire educational process, started here at Purdue, and I think I'm going to elaborate on this because I think it's extremely important. In the 1950s, pharmacy was primarily a distribution profession. The pharmacist packaged prescription products, of which there were multitudes, and gave them to the patients, and it was a commercial transaction. And even the people who studied pharmacy heard a lot of complaints from the practicing pharmacists that this is a routine thing, and the profession wasn't really as highly thought of as a profession as it deserved. And a number of us in education were trying to figure out what to do, how to stimulate first a pride in pharmacy, and second, opportunity for pharmacists to really do what they're trained to do. And at Purdue, I was trying to think of what it is that I didn't know that the students should know about pharmacy. And I realized that we were teaching them about drugs, but nothing about the diseases or the impact of these drugs upon the patient. So I started thinking, well, if a pharmacist is going to give a patient a drug for high blood pressure or for diabetes or for any chronic disease, he should know about that disease and how the patient feels and why the patient's taking it. And we started changing the slant of our teaching to bring in more components of medicine and what I call the clinical aspect. And concurrently with my thinking, other teachers were also thinking the same, and I think the beginning of clinical pharmacy was at a District 4 meeting of NABP in Wisconsin when a colleague of mine named John Audion got up and talked about what pharmacy needed, and he said, we need a new name for prescription services, and he says, something that is clinical. And that rang a bell with me, and I came back and we started thinking about clinical, and I thought, well, clinical pharmacy, that's really what it's all about. And in the simplest sense, our concept of clinical pharmacy was that it means a clinical situation in which a pharmacist interacts with a patient and provides help and information about taking his medicine. It was that simple, and yet it was that complex. And I asked Dean Jenkins if I could use the name clinical pharmacy on any courses. And at that time we were revising a text, and I said, this dispensing text really should be, it had been called The Art of Compounding. And I said, pharmacy is changing, so there's very little compounding anymore. Why don't we call the new text Clinical Pharmacy? And Dean Jenkins thought a minute, and he said, well, he said, we've got to go forward, and we'll do that. And then we had trouble with the publisher, because the Art of Compounding, the older text which we had previously edited, revised, was an established book. It was one of the two most widely used books in the country. And the publishers didn't want to let us change the title. But through Dean Jenkins' efforts, he did convince them that we should have a new book and a new concept, and that was how the book Clinical Pharmacy came out. But the use of clinical pharmacy at Purdue wasn't even that easy, because our faculty objected to it. Well, two members of our faculty objected to it, and they were quite vocal. They felt that clinical implied some type of free clinics, and they just couldn't conceive of the idea of having an all-embracing relationship between pharmacist, physician, and patient. Again, though, Dean Jenkins persuaded them that we could use clinical pharmacy, and so we began at Purdue to use the word clinical pharmacy to expand upon the concept that the pharmacist could tell a patient about what's in a prescription and how to use it. And then we began to publicize it. And we can document this date, that it was in the year 1963 when clinical pharmacy became official at Purdue, and it was the first in the country. And I was the first professor of clinical pharmacy in the United States, in the world, I guess. And Dr. Belcastro, who was the only other professor in my department, was also an associate professor of clinical pharmacy. So that is documented, and we established that. The other schools looked with interest, and initially there was an awful lot of resistance to it. The schools in California, who had earlier adopted the Doctor of Pharmacy degree, embraced it and sort of took the ball and ran with it. And pretty soon, all over the country, clinical pharmacy was becoming to be talked of as a course, and it just grew and grew and grew very rapidly. There were, of course, a lot of other people who claimed different concepts of clinical pharmacy. Some tried to make it a specialty, and it's still highly controversial in some issues as to what it embraces. But the undisputable fact is that we started at Purdue, and has become now a integral part of all pharmaceutical education, and it has. You ask about the impact. The impact has been that it has completely changed the public's image and acceptance of the pharmacist. He's now accepted as a knowledgeable person on drugs who, in fact, is mandated by law to talk to patients and tell them about the possible effects of their medications and the proper use. And this is in a direct contrast to what it was in the early 50s when pharmacists couldn't even tell a patient what was in their prescription.
I think you've covered clinical pharmacy very nicely, and I want to maybe pick up a little bit of loose ends here. And do you have anything more to say about your role as associate dean of the school and notable developments that came about and how you might have influenced them?
I think probably the major influence during my tenure was establishing a strong system for giving the students a strong system for recruiting and retaining the top students in the school. We were able to refine an already established system of interviews in which we, for the first time, had actual personal interviews with every student who wanted to come into the school. And we had a selection committee which had to be really hard-nosed because we couldn't accept all the applicants. But we established a clear-cut, firm policy, which everyone understood, that a personal interview was required, that there were criteria that had to be met, that there was no longer any type of admission of an unqualified student, even though he may be the son or the daughter of the president of the company. And then the second thing that we established was a very good, strong student counseling service. We were able, while I was the associate dean, to set up a whole division of student counseling and had a director of student counseling. We initially had two people in that division. Now I think they have five. A third thing that we were able to do was to involve the students more in outside activities. I think probably one of the strongest things that we were able to do was to establish liaisons with other institutions to encourage our students to spend some time under academic supervision in those institutions. So the three major things that I think were the establishment of a strong interview and recruitment program, the establishment of a very effective student counseling program, and the establishment of an external experience program for the students.
You've already talked about some of your publications, your book on clinical pharmacy and the hospital pharmacy notes that you did for the Eli Lilly Company. Do you want to talk about any other publications, the nature of them, and what you feel is most significant about them?
Well, first thing, again, I would want to repeat is that the text which we had on clinical pharmacy was the first, and it made clinical pharmacy a well-known name around the country. And the effect of that really can't be underestimated because it helped establish this whole new program. I also wrote a manual on cosmetics, which we use here at Purdue and a number of other schools. It wasn't a bestseller because there were so very few schools that taught courses in cosmetics. But it was published, is in the library, and again, our students found much satisfaction and pleasure from it. The publications is not limited to books. I guess I have had articles in practically every pharmaceutical journal and a great number of medical journals, and I have quit counting my publications. When I got over 200, I just sort of quit counting them.
You've made notable contributions to the profession of pharmacy, to the university, to the state of Indiana, and the community. Would you like to mention and discuss some of those that stand out?
Well, I'd have to give some thought to this to really be concise, but to me, the greatest contribution that I think I made was the contribution to the students and to the pharmacists of the state and even the nation now, because I was able to work with them and I think impress upon them a sense of professional pride and responsibility. And I think my greatest achievement is having so many of our students go out and be successful and continually contact me and tell me of their advance and their progress. At the community level, I tried to have some activity in the community too. I, for several years, well, I started and was the chairman of the Elks Blood Bank, which typed and kept records of the blood types of all our members and made blood available free to those who need it, at least made the contacts. I served as on the board of directors of the Tippecanoe County Mental Health Association for a number of years and was an officer of that. and I'm still currently on the Nursing Education Committee, which is a advisory committee for the School of Nursing and the community.
I know that you have a number of hobby interests, such as a collection of pharmacy antiques and also stamps and coins. Would you like to comment on these?
Well, I think everybody ought to have a hobby. And I became, of course, interested in stamps when I was a boy and sporadically collected them and then put them aside for a while. But I've always had an interest in stamps because, to me, they have been a very excellent educational tool. You just absorb information and knowledge about countries and people and events from studying stamps. So I have an extensive stamp collection. When my son was little, he started saving pennies, and as a result of that, I became interested in coins and have acquired them too. Had a number of them stolen some years ago, which sort of dampened my enthusiasm for that. And so far as pharmacy antiques is concerned, I have had many years a relationship with a pharmacy state board inspector who was also interested in antiques. And as he would go around the state, many of my students who were remodeling their drug stores would say, "I've got this old junk. Do you want to give it to Sprandio?" And he would bring it back, and I would go out with him to the stores, and we would collect and sort out and share old pharmacy jars and mortars and pestles and balances and things like that. But eventually, I had so much that I had no more room for it, and offered to give it to the school, but Dean Jenkins said that to have a museum, you must have a curator and space and maintain it properly, and they had none of that. I offered to give it to the Tippecanoe County Historical Society, and they said all they would do would be box it up and put it in the archives, and perhaps somebody might use it sometime. So I disposed of it through giving some of it away and selling some of it. So at this time, I have very few pharmacy antiques.
Now for some final questions. What were your goals and were they accomplished?
Most of my goals were short-term goals. My first goal was to get a master's degree and then get a PhD, and then to be a good teacher and then to be a good administrator. All of them, I think, were accomplished as time went on. My ultimate goals were to have a good, productive career, to have a good family life, and all in all, just to have a full and happy life. And I think they've been accomplished quite well. I'm pleased to have had all the experiences I've had, and I wouldn't trade them for anything. They've enabled me through my profession to travel over most of the world, to meet many prominent people, to share in a lot of common activities. And all in all, I think the goal could be summarized by just saying to lead a full and productive life.
I think I know what the answer to this is going to be, but what do you think has been your most significant contribution?
Well, I'll bet you don't know what my answer would be. I think, really, my most significant contribution has been to the students that came to Purdue. I have made many, many good friends, and the contribution has been that I feel that I have helped them be successful. And in being successful, I think they reflected on Purdue. So I think my most significant contribution really has been to help establish the Purdue University School of Pharmacy and Pharmacosciences as the leader in pharmaceutical education. Of course, the establishment and recognition of clinical pharmacy has to be, I suppose, of equal importance nationally. But we've got these two things. To me, the most significant thing is the success of all my students. And I think perhaps visibly to the world of pharmacy, the most significant contribution has been perhaps the establishment of clinical pharmacy.
Are there any particular activities that you derive the most satisfaction from?
Well, I derive satisfaction from all of them, I think. Each one, in its own way, gives you much pleasure and much satisfaction. Teaching certainly was first, research was second, but participation in the professional activities, the professional organizations, has to be greatly satisfying as well. I guess I'd say all of them, each in its own way, was equally gratifying to the others.
Would you like to give credit to some individuals that have encouraged or influenced or assisted you in your career?
Well, of course, I can't give enough credit to Dean Jenkins. He, as I've said, forced you to perform really beyond your capabilities. I think Dean Jenkins' encouragement and support and guidance and pressures were directly responsible for most of the advancements that I made in the profession. I have to give credit to my wife because for all the years that I was working, she supported me and gave me every type of encouragement to do what I wanted to do and tolerated so much of my absences from home and carried on to raise our son when I was not around. I think, too, that perhaps much influence stemmed from the executives of some of the major pharmaceutical houses with whom I had contact and who, in their own way, guided me to other contacts, which led directly to significant specific career advancement. And, of course, I can't forget Dean Tyler. He was so much totally different from Dean Jenkins in his way of doing things, but fully as effective. And through Dean Tyler's excuse me, friendship and encouragement and support, I was able to really reach the peak of my career. I'd have to say Dean Jenkins' support was that of a superior, an administrator, and a father. Dean Tyler's support was that of a colleague and a friend, and the two of them both deserve tremendous gratitude for helping me achieve what both of us wanted to do.
Well, if there's nothing else, well, that'll conclude our session.